Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and, she says, rubbing her hands gleefully, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly, the films Vivarium, The Wolf House, and The Painter and the Thief. Well, again, too easy. Hi, David. How are you?
Doing okay, Joe. How are you doing this week?
Won't complain. That's
well,
going to be my, yeah, I know. What a bore. Next.
Yeah. No. I'm glad you can't complain or won't complain or are not complaining. And you said you were rubbing your hands in glee. I'm not sure you'll be rubbing them in such glee when I'm done today, because these are three fairly dark films. They're also films that have practically nothing in common with one another. And I'd like to start by talking a bit about Vivarium, which is sort of being pushed as a science fiction movie. I guess it is a science fiction movie, but I didn't exactly find it that. I found it more of a kind of a horror movie, because it really is kind of horrific in what happens. Above all, it's a very dreamlike, strange, and sort of surrealistic movie. And in a way, if anything connects these three films today, maybe it's sort of that. But they all have this surrealistic kind of a feel to them. So anyway, Vivarium is the story of a young couple who are played by Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, two perfectly good performers who do a very nice job in this movie. And they are a young couple, and they want to buy a house, and they go to a real estate agent, and this is the very beginning of the movie, and this is when the movie first starts to show its real strangeness, because this guy who sells them the house, this guy named Martin, is just a very strange person in his affect. There is something very, very, very weird about this guy. Anyway, he tells them about a new real estate development of lovely houses called Yonder, and he says this is going to be just the place for you. So with Martin, the young couple, whose names are Gemma and Tom, drive out to this development, and he shows them this house, and it seems like a perfectly nice little house. One thing that's a little bit creepy here is that every single house on the block seems to be exactly identical to every other single house on the block. Also, we don't see any other people. But when the young couple are finished sort of looking around the house, they look for Martin, and he is gone. The real estate agent has simply vanished. He is not there. So they say, okay, well, let's drive back home and, you know, we'll think about this. And they get into their car and they can't find their way out of the development. They can't find their way out of Yonder. And they drive and they drive and they drive, and they are going around in circles, and they are following the sun, and they're doing this and they're doing that, and they just can't seem to get anywhere. So now we are really in sort of dreamlike territory here. Poor Gemma and Tom appear to be sort of trapped in this place. And again, their real estate agent has totally vanished. And, you know, this is not exactly a spoiler. They never get out of that place. The whole movie really takes place there. And the big change that happens, again, quite early in the movie, is that suddenly there is a baby there with them. Just a little baby. And with some instructions, and the instructions are that they are to raise this baby, and then at the end of that process, they will be released. So, of course, that sounds like they're going to be there now for, I suppose, decades. Now, as it turns out, the baby grows up rather faster than babies actually grow up in the real world. But the baby turns out to be just as strange and sinister as Martin, just as strange and sinister as Yonder. The baby turns out to be very, very weird and very, very strange. So here's the point of the movie, is that Gemma and Tom are stuck in this place. There is no way they can get out. There are no other people there. And now they have this infant who keeps growing up and growing up and growing up. And so various things happen along the way. At one point, Tom apparently gets the very strange idea that maybe he can dig their way out of yonder. So he starts digging a hole, and the hole gets deeper and deeper, and that goes on for a long time. And, well, I won't tell you how the whole movie turns out, but yes, the whole thing turns out to be very, very strange. Possibly this is the work of aliens from some other galaxy or something like that, but that's just a hypothesis on my part. It's also possible that they're just, this whole thing is supernatural and not really science fictional at all. So anyway, the whole thing is very, very bizarre. So this sounds like the kind of movie that's sort of like one of a kind. It was directed by Lorcan Finnegan, by the way, from a screenplay by Garrett Shanley, and from a story that they wrote together. And it sounds really unique. Like, you know, my feeling for a little while watching the film was, well, I've never seen anything like this before. And then I realized I sort of have seen things like this before. It has a very David Lynch kind of feel to it. Almost a Twin Peaks feel to it, if you can imagine a Twin Peaks with only two or three characters in it. Has sort of that feeling to it. And even more, some of the work of Charlie Kaufman, the famous writer of movies like Being John Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He directed his own movie some years ago called Synecdoche, New York. And again, this movie with a lot of characters, but Vivarium reminded me of that in various ways. So it's a movie that is at one time very, very strange, very unusual. There's nothing else out there or maybe never has been anything else quite like it before, and yet it is similar to some of these other movies with very strange and kind of self-consciously surrealistic feelings, attitudes, moods to them. So I can't say that Vivarium is a great movie, even if you're a science fiction or surrealistic movie fan. I found it rather tiring after a while, but I'm always impressed by movies that are such acts of imagination. You have some filmmakers here who came up with a very, very unusual idea. Again, not a unique one, but an unusual one, and had the courage to follow it all the way through. Got a couple of terrific performers involved, Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, and followed it through and made exactly, apparently, the movie that they wanted to make. So if this is your cup of Witch's Brew, this sort of strange, surrealistic, otherworldly material with only a couple of characters going through a terrible ordeal for about an hour and a half, then Vivarium is definitely something to check out. It is not a movie for the masses, but that is one of the reasons why I really do kind of respect it. Everybody makes movies for the masses. I'm always impressed when people make a movie that will not be for the masses, but that is apparently just what they wanted to make. Now, our second movie for today is an animated film, The Wolf House, and it was directed by Joaquin Cosiña and Cristobal León, and it is a very, very disturbing animation. There was a time when most of us thought of animations usually as being, Disney movies, or nowadays we might say Pixar movies. That's what animations tend to be. They're kind of lighthearted, they tend to be for the family, that sort of thing, and of course there's a million exceptions to that, and The Wolf House is one of those exceptions that goes directly in the other direction. Original title, La Casa Lobo. And it reminds me, and again, there is a definite precedent. There are definitely people who have made very, very dark and surrealistic animations over the years, particularly a couple of young animators who make short films named The Brothers Quay. And this reminded me very much of their work. Also an Eastern European animator named Jan Svankmajer. The Wolf House is very much in their sort of lineage. It is, by the way, its provenance. It is Chilean and German. And it definitely has both South American and German connections. So The Wolf House, and what I'm about to say now, I can only give the slightest idea of even what the film is about. It would take much too long to get into it, much more than that. But I'll just try to give a brief little idea. And this will take up most of the time I have to spend on the movie, just telling a little bit about it. But once upon a time, there was a colony in Chile, which was set up by a German refugee. A German emigrant, a former Nazi, who set up this colony, which was called Colonia Dignidad, and the people lived there by raising and selling honey, but it was basically a Nazi refuge, and they harbored fugitive Nazis who managed to flee there and get away from there and hide out there, and all kinds of horrors went on there. Even though this is now after the Nazi era itself, these former Nazis and these Nazi refugees down there, living, by the way, under the protection of the horrible Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, they were engaged in all kinds of horrors, including pedophilia. So this movie, The Wolf House, which is an animated film, is from the point of view of a child living in the wolf house. And it is not any kind of a direct sort of documentary animation that shows horrors like pedophilia and so forth. It is actually much more allusive than that. It only suggests these things, but it suggests them through these utterly dreamlike, and I should say nightmarish, visuals. It is one of these animations in which anything can happen and everything does. And to me, this kind of movie wears out its welcome before it's over a lot of the time. And that was the case with The Wolf House. When there is no limit to the kinds of audiovisual transformations and morphings and nightmarish changes and shifts of point of view and one thing melding and merging into another, when there's no limit to that, when literally anything can happen, that kind of over-the-topness gets to me after a while, and I start to say, when you have an imagined world, the world has to have rules, it has to have limits, and The Wolf House has those, but they're so completely unstable in so many ways that after a while, the movie kind of started to annoy me more than anything else. However, if one is interested in a truly nightmarish visual adventure, and if one is interested in the kind of subject matter that this movie touches on, which is very real 20th century horror of the Nazi and escaped Nazi and Augusto Pinochet variety, then it is a movie which will really, really fascinate you. And anybody who is interested in the kind of farthest reaches of animation and what animation can accomplish, then The Wolf House is definitely worth checking out. I'm very glad that I saw it, and I'm very glad that I found out some of the background of it, but I have to say that it is like, as one critic put it, it's like a fairy tale which is grimmer than grim, and it is only, shall we say, for the, it is not for the squeamish, to use a real cliche here. Final movie I want to talk about today is, unlike these other two very dreamlike films that I've talked about, The Painter and the Thief is a documentary, but it also has a kind of a dreamlike quality to it. It was directed by one Benjamin Rie, and it is a Norwegian film, and it starts out by showing footage of an actual theft that took place. A couple of what appear to be young men, and they turn out to have been young men, went into an art gallery, and they stole a couple of paintings, and the paintings are of a very gifted painter named Kari Birtle Nordland. Excuse me, I said that wrong. Boy, oh boy. Her name is Bara Kisilkova, and she is an Eastern European painter, a very gifted one. And the theft that took place, they didn't just cut the paintings out of their frames when they stole these two very large paintings from this gallery. They actually removed all the little nails that were holding the canvas into the frame, something that would have taken a professional an hour to do. But they did this, and then they rolled up the canvases and they left. And they did this on one level so brilliantly that they successfully removed all the little nails and rolled up the canvases and made their getaway and all of that. So this showed real expertise on their part. On the other hand, there they are kind of walking away from the gallery, totally on surveillance video, as if they were total idiots who had no idea that they would be caught probably really, really quickly because, you know, they're on camera. So anyway, they got away with the paintings, and this is all the very beginning of the movie. And they were arrested. At least one of them was arrested. And he turns out to be a guy named Carl Bertel Nordland. And the painter then did something very, very unusual. She really wanted to meet this guy. So at the time of his trial, she went to the courtroom and she just went up and started talking to him and said, "I would really like to get to know you a bit." And she said, "In fact, I would like to paint you." So she did. She, after he was through the court system and back at large again. She went and she got to know him, and she got to know him very well, and she started to paint him, and she painted this very large portrait of him, which moved him to his soul. The movie has in it the moment when he first sees the finished painting, and he is so overwhelmed by this painting. It's one of the most touching things I've seen in a documentary probably in years. Remarkable, remarkable scene. And the movie proceeds from there, and it turns out to be about the long-term relationship, not a romance, not a love story. They both have other romantic partners, but this very long relationship between, as the title of the film tells us, the painter and the thief. Now, their relationship goes through all sorts of permutations. There are ups and downs. It's not entirely a happy relationship, but it's a very, very close and, in its own strange way, intimate relationship. The movie meanders. It's full of mood and atmosphere more than events and personalities, but you get to know these two people quite well, and I found it a really absorbing film. It's a strange film. It's not a conventional documentary in a lot of ways, but it really engaged me. It pulled me in, and I felt really just a marvelous time spending about an hour and a half in the company of these two very unusual personalities. So The Painter and the Thief is a strange documentary in its own way. It's sort of a dreamlike documentary, but it's a really, really interesting one. And for those interested in the art world, as I know you are, Jill, it's a movie really worth checking out. So that is my quite diversified story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you very much, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films Vivarium, The Wolf House, and The Painter and the Thief.